It's the wind down of our 21st summer up here. So my name is Rudy Edmond, and those of you who might not know, and I'm a geologist. And after doing this for 21 summers, I'm sure you don't want to hear a two-hour lecture that's been repeated that many times, and I'm not going to give you one. So what I am going to do is to try to tell you some of the things that have impressed me about the mine and the history of the mine up here, just to give you a few highlights, and then I want you to ask questions. And so if you generate the questions, things that you want to know, then we'll deal with them with the whole group, and by the time we're back to dinner hour, dinner tonight, and I remind you that we've never missed a lunch on one of these excursions, so we always get back in time for food. So you help me keep time with the watch, and we'll not miss another one tonight. So think about the things you want to know, and then we'll ask it, and that way we'll keep a record of what's going on, what has gone on in relationship to the mine. Let me start off by telling you that this is a very hostile kind of place for human beings to live on a year-round basis. It's a very difficult place to conceive that a mine would be developed, but that's exactly what happened, and so it's interesting to know what the circumstances are that led to it and how it did come about. You know, even the animals pretty much stay out of this valley because the snow is so heavy here in the wintertime that it's very difficult for even the deer. They move out of here. And most of the big animals can't take this. And the Indians, you see, didn't even pay much attention to this valley. So to think that there was a mine that was developed, and now that we're all here, you know, it's not an easy place to get to. So I don't have to convince you that this is back in the wilderness, back in the sticks. So how did it happen? Well, the first thing that happens in the valley that's important, as far as the mine is concerned, is that the Great Northern Railway decided they wanted to put their track through to the West Coast. And when they made that decision, they made a decision to survey different routes that were possible to accomplish that. One of the routes that they surveyed was this particular route that they would come up along Lake Chelan, develop a track, then come up Railroad Creek Canyon, and then tunnel through at the head of Railroad Creek Canyon. Then they would be on the side where they could go on to the West Coast without a great deal of difficulty. Well, that's important for a couple of reasons. One, it's a time when maps were being made in this area. And so when that was under consideration, and they were looking for names to put on to canyons and streams and so on, this canyon got to be called Railroad Creek and Railroad Creek Canyon. There's never been a railroad here. There probably never will be one, but it'll always be Railroad Creek Canyon. So that's an interesting aspect of it. Now the other thing about that survey, which occurred in 1887, and that's when they brought in a crew here to survey that possibility. They found out a couple of things that were important. One was that everything they tested along that route where they might put the track was harder than steel. You know, and when you start to build a railroad where all the rock is harder than steel, you know you're in for some expense. And they elected to choose another route rather than to fight this hard rock and the difficulty of the grade up here. So they abandoned the idea of putting a railroad through here. But in the survey, it became known that there were certain mineral outcrops in the valley that showed some prospect. And they noted that in their report. And then a man by the name of John H. Holden, who is a prospector in the area, picks up on that information and elects to come up here and prospect in the valley. And in so doing, like all good prospectors, they always seem to be broke, never have enough money, and so they need to hunt up friends who are going to help them make their stake and also make it for them. So he did exactly that, and he hunted up the wealthy families in the Seattle area and other places around, and talked them into grub staking him to come up here. And that's exactly what happened. So after 1887 and the railroad bows out, then Holden comes in 1892. And he brings in a crew, and he begins to dig. He finds the outcrop up here on the side of the mountain, and that was noted. And I'll just pass this around. You can take a look at it, because this is what outcrops right up here on the mountain. And if I in the morning, it's easy for me to show you exactly where this outcrop is. In the afternoon, the sun is such that it's shaded, and so it's hard to see this brown outcrop, but it's right up above those tailings that you can see going up along the side of the mountain. Now, what they saw was this rusty outcrop of rock, which doesn't look like anything on the outside, but when you break it open, you can see that there are minerals here that might be important. And this is where the copper, actually, and the copper minerals are actually exposed in that particular outcrop. So it's interesting that the ore body, which they finally mined out, had only one spot where it stuck out of the side of the mountain. You know, that was just fortunate for the people who came up here to prospect, that they found that outcrop and then began to follow it, and it led into the ore body, which was really quite extensive in the mountain proper. Now, I think at this point, let me just give you a kind of an outline of what that ore body is like. This is the point where it sticks out of the side of the mountain, would be, say, if my hand represented the ore body, it would be right here on my hand. Now, the ore body extends down through the mountain and into the mountain in about this angle, almost vertical. And this is where the outcrop was noted, where the outcrop really gave the clue to what was in the mountain. And then when they finally mined it out, they found that the ore body ran for a half a mile, 2,500 feet, horizontally in that direction and in the direction of Buckskin Mountain, and also lining up with Holden Lake up on the other side of the valley, so that's where the alignment of the ore body was. It also was mined down from this very upper point here, which you start numbering at zero, the very top of the ore body. They mined down 2,500 feet vertically, so that's another half a mile. So the statistics are kind of easy to remember. It's a half a mile this way, it's a half a mile that way, and the thickness of my hand would represent the ore body, and that's about 80 feet. So it's about 80 feet by those dimensions. And the mine then was developed, of course, in that sliver, which is in the mountain, which is a broken zone, where the rocks were fractured slightly by just enough movement to allow the breakage of the rock, and that allowed the ore minerals to come in at a time when the mountains were being formed. Now let's go back and pick up a little of the history that leads to all of this and give you a little better idea of what happened. Now, Holden, from 1892 to 1896, then finds this outcrop and begins to work it. And the tailings that you see up there are evidence of what he was able to do. Now, the only way he had of working it was to dig it out with pick and shovel and then put it on pack animals and take it down through the game trails down to the lake, and then finally, of course, out to where it could be assayed and processed. So it was a very difficult way, and all he could do was high grade the ore, take the best chunks, and leave the rest, and proceed in that manner. Well, Holden filed his claims between 1892 and 1896. And the odd thing is, you know, that he had a very bad memory. because all these friends that he got money from and was going to make rich, when it came time to file the claims, he forgot all of their names. He didn't remember a single one. And so nobody's name got on the claims except Holder. And that led to a whole series of bad feelings, as you might imagine, and hiring of lawyers and lawsuits and various things that began to occur from that point on. Now, if you're interested in this part of the story, and I can't take the time to really tell you all about it, if you're interested in that part of the story, get Nigel Adams' book, which is in the bookstore. And this winter, when you have your feet up and you're thinking about this nice hot afternoon hiking up to the mine, think about some of the stories of Holden and some of the shenanigans that some people thought that he was guilty of. Well, anyway, if you don't want to buy the book, it'll cost you, I think, $5. And if you don't want to buy that, then go pick up a tape by Nigel Adams, and you'll find that and sit down and listen to it. That'll be worth your while, too. And there are other sources of information that are available similar to that, but think about that as a possibility. Now, what are the things about Nigel Adams? How did it happen this book became available here in the village? It's this way, that Nigel lived here during the time the mine was in operation as a young boy. And he went to the school down here, which we call Narnia. And he graduated from there. He went on out to high school. And then he came to the University of Washington in Seattle. And he was working on a doctor's degree. And he decided that it would be nice if the professors would approve of him writing up the history of this particular development in this valley. Well, since he was a part of it, you know, naturally he had a great interest in it. Well, there's a little interesting sidelight to this bit of information. And that's the fact that when I made my first trip in here in 1962, I was thrilled to find a lot of things that I just want to tell you just a little bit about. When I got up here and made the same trip you're making this afternoon on my own, I went to the assay house up here where we're going later on. And one of the things I saw up at the assay house was the fact that here on the wall of the assay house was the original work diagram, work chart, you know, of the production of the mine right up to the last day it closed. You know, put in pencil with the pencil notes on it, colored pen and so on. And then I went into the geologist's office, which was in the same building, and I found the geological maps of the last place, the 2,500 foot level, where they were just completing, you know, their operation there. And I went up to the engineering building, which is the tin building you see up on top of the upper tailing. And when I got up there, I went into the drafting room. And in the drafting room, I found the big drafting tables. And in the drawers still were the original linens that they had drafted for the various levels of the mine, the various plans for the village and the camp and everything else. They were all there, and there was a stack of them that thick with the original India ink on them. Well, then I went to the mill, and I found the records in the mill, and there were still all the work records in pencil and so on were still in the mill. And I came down to the hospital, and I looked in the rooms up there, and here were the medical records, you know, on a basis, you know, that you could follow what happened over the period of years, the various accidents and things that had been treated, and so on. Well, that was my first visit, my first trip. And when I got back to the dining hall and got back and began to visit with the director at that time, I asked the question, who is going to take care of all of these records and see that this kind of information is still preserved for the future, because it may be very valuable at some point down the line in case the mine were to be reopened. And you know what happens when you start talking in church like that. Somebody points their finger right at you and says, well, how about you being chairman of that committee? You know, that sort of thing. So that's how I got involved up here. I came out here in 1962 to see the World's Fair in Seattle. And my daughter was with me, and Doris, of course, and we decided we just had to come up here and see what this was all about. I was interested professionally, as well as because of the church gift that we knew had just occurred. And so that's how I got into it. Let me tell you about one room that I found up in the engineering room, where the files were all the way around the wall. You know, these nice four-drawer files, which you can easily pull out. Well, they had been pulled out, literally, and people had rifled through those, and instead of putting the papers back in the drawers, they dumped them on the floor. And they were in the middle of the floor, and one of the rooms I came into had a stack of paper as high as my chin, and it tapered off about 10 feet across. Now that was the paper that was in the file, had been in the file, in those file cabinets. And so that was one of the things that, where the roof now had caved in, there was snowing on it, you see, in the winter, and so it obviously wasn't gonna last long. Well, that's the kind of thing that we got involved in. Somebody says, well, you helped do it. And I said, yes, if you can provide a crew of young people that would be interested in digging in to this kind of record, then yes, I'll come back the next year and we'll start working at it. And we did. And I spent the whole summer with a crew of college youngsters, and we worked then to get these papers together. We put them back in boxes and files, whatever. Obviously couldn't get it back the way it was by any means. We didn't have that kind of time. But we did get it out of the weather. And the question was then where were we going to put it? Well, I asked for space down here in the village. And you know, space was at a premium, like it always is. You know, everybody wants space. So when I asked for that, they told me, yes, you can have the potato room downstairs underneath the dining hall. And that had a dirt floor, and we had mice and all of that kind of thing. But that was minor compared with what we had up here in the mine area. So yes, we brought it down. We put it in the potato room. Now, to tie into this, we got all the records in there in the next three or four summers that we could gather and pick up. That's when Nigel Adams appeared on the scene. And Nigel now had approval from the university to do his dissertation on this area, and he wanted all of these records. Well, we had just gotten them together, and so then that presented a question of how we were going to deal with it. It was a question of whether Nigel should come here and work in our potato room, or whether we were going to release the records and let him take them out and work with them, you know, over at the university. Well, the upshot of it was this, that the archives people at the University of Washington said, if you will release the records to our archives, we'll let Nigel work with them over in Seattle, and we'll keep them for you permanently, and they will be available as when you might need them or want them. In other words, they'll always be on file. That's exactly what happened. Now, after spending all of this time and telling you about this, I can't show you a single piece of paper that we gathered, you know. It's all over there. But we do know it's available. And now that we have a museum, we know that we can copy things, we can bring things back here on loan, we can do various kinds of things with that material. And so it's not lost. It's there, you see, from now on, and we can then use it, deal with it. And that's important to the corporation, and it's important to us. Now, I said I wasn't going to lecture for 2 hours, and I'm not. So, does anybody have a question at this point? The concrete tunnel
by the bridge,
right by the footbridge where we go across. That's where the drinking water for the mining company for the village here that they built. They brought a line from Copper Basin, which is right up there, brought it down, and it goes under the creek at that point. And they also had connections there for fire purposes. so that they could divert water from that point to other places in the village, and so it was a fire control area. Now we don't use it in that way, but we still use the original pipe that comes down for our water supply here in the village. Well, okay, I'm going to mention one other thing, then we're going to walk a little ways. You know, this is going to be a shady talk if I can find shade. I don't know where it's going to be, but we're going to keep looking for it up the line. It's a little warm. But when Holden's interest plays out, which is in 1918, Holden is the dominant influence from 1892 to 1918. Then Holden dies of cancer. And that means that what was left, the residue of what was available at that point, was held by his wife, and she then had control and then began to work with this with other parties. Now, nothing really happens from 1918 until 1928, and that's when the Howe Sound Mining Company of Canada becomes interested in this as a possible place to open a large mine. And they sent in a man by the name of Mr. Barquist, and I'm going to show you his picture when we get up to the museum. Mr. Barquist came in and had the assignment to study the possibility of opening this mine here. And he had a company took a four-year option. This was 1928 to 1932. And by 1932, they had to make a decision to either open the mine or to give the Holden interests the information that they had gathered. Then they would have something further to promote. You see, so it was a good deal on both sides. And you could think about the time of this. You couldn't have picked 4 years that probably were worse. You see, in terms of time, this is right in the heart of the Depression. The price of copper during that study dropped way down, and the Depression was in full bloom in 1932, and they had to make a decision one way or the other. They elected to go ahead. And when they did that, they then knew that they had to go ahead and spend money in addition to build a village. They had to build this road. They had to build the mill. They had to dig a tunnel back into the ore body. And all of that had to happen before they could get any money back. Now, keep in mind, they start spending money in 1928. And it's 1938 before that mill up there was able to turn out concentrate that they could sell. That means that during that span, they had invested $5 million upfront money. And they had to have a lot of faith, you know, that they were going to get that $5 million back and make a profit, you see, in operating this mine. Well, that's what made it possible to open this valley. Then they did build the road, and they did build all the things that we see are here today. And the mine did run from 1957, when they first started to dig out of the mountain, until 1937 to 57. That's 20 years. And it ran 3 shifts every day for 20 years solid. And it was a very successful mine. They recovered $100 million in metals from that mine. $70 million of that was copper, $21 million of it was gold, and the balance was zinc and silver. So it was mainly a copper mine with a substantial amount of gold. Now, anybody have a question?
How much copper did you say?
How much copper? The copper amounted to $70 million out of the $100 million. That's the easiest figure to remember. And if you're interested in more statistics and details, there is a little book called The Mine, which has a lot of the details, statistics in it. And I wrote that in the early years, and it sells for $1, and I don't get a cent out of it, so don't worry about making me rich.
Where did they smelt it? They milled it here. Where did they smelt it?
They smelted it in Tacoma. Now, when we get up to the museum, I want you to ask questions about all of that, and we'll deal with that further when we get up there. Okay? Now.
Did they exhaust the vein, or did it get too expensive?
Okay. All right, let's deal with that. What they did was to drive a tunnel. I said they had to do that. They drove it into the ore body, which is my hand. And when they got to that, that's a half a mile long, that tunnel. And when they got here, then they began to develop tunnels all the way. They mined from the 1,500-foot level, which means it's down from the top, 1,500 feet now. And they mined then up instead of down. And when they had mined out everything up, then they started mining down. And they went on down 1,000 feet below this tunnel. And that meant that they were at the 2,500-foot level, and they were lifting the ore 1,000 feet. Now, before they elected and decided to abandon the mine, they went ahead and cored down from the base where they were operating. They cored another 700 feet down, and they knew they had the same kind of material for another 700 feet. That was never touched, and that material is still there. Now, it is a matter of record that the copper ore was getting leaner as they were going down, but the gold content was hanging in very well, and so the gold was paying the overhead, and they were just making whatever they were making from the copper. But why didn't the mine close in 57? It closed for economic reasons, very specifically because the price of copper dropped in 1957 from 46 cents a pound to 26 cents a pound. And when that happened, that was the crowning blow, you see, economically. The company was losing money, and they decided that there was no point in going on. They knew that lifting the ore from even a greater depth, you know, it was going to be more expensive than what it was then. The other thing is that they had explored to try to find another ore body in that direction in the Buckskin Mountain, and they explored up in the Holden Lake area, and they were unsuccessful. They spent $1.5 million looking for another ore body in this valley, and they did not find it. And that, you see, was again a very decisive thing when it came time to consider closing the mine. Well, we said this was going to be a hike, and we're going to hike right now. So we'll go up the road. Alfound Mining Company didn't use the Holden shafts at all for taking anything in or out of the mine or the ore body. They mined up to those tailings where you see them on the mountainside. Then they left the shafts, just open enough to allow ventilation into the mine. So it was a way of ventilating the mine, but not using it to bring anything out or take anything in. That's the way they used it. Still some occupancy in Honeymoon Heights up until 1941 and 42. And that's when the company insisted that everybody move out of Honeymoon Heights, because at that point they'd had a number of avalanches up in that area, and it was a dangerous area. And so they insisted that everybody live over on this side of Railroad Creek. And that's when Honeymoon Heights was abandoned. Now, that's a good place for you to go, you know, if you want to take a hike, and I'd recommend that.
How much bigger was the village than what's left now? Were there other buildings?
Yes, we're going to go on and see some more of it, but the total population of the village, the time when the mine was in operation, was in excess of 700, 750 people, and up to 800 and 850 people. You know, it's twice as big as it is right now, in terms of numbers and the people that lived in the valley here. And they lived, we're going to go up to where many of them built their own homes. And we'll go up there in a little bit, and I'll show you that. Yeah. Okay, another question? Any other questions? Okay, I want to change your thinking here for a minute. I want you to look straight ahead at the mountain you see. which is Bonanza Peak. Bonanza Peak is the biggest mountain in the Northern Cascades, the highest, 9,500 feet, where it's a crystalline mountain, crystalline rock. I told you the rock was harder than steel, and I mean this whole range is that way, and this is one of the, this is the largest of the crystalline mountains in the Northern Cascades. Now there is a higher mountain in the Northern Cascades, and that is Glacier Peak. But that's a volcano which builds up on top of the plain of the Cascade Mountain. So it's a different kind of mountain entirely. But what I want you to see is if you look at that snowfield on the left-hand side, see the ridge? Now, do you notice the change in color of the material as you look at that ledge? You're looking at the front of an advancing glacier. That is an active glacier, and it's moving in this direction. Now, what I want you to just think about is that if the climate changed and it were to get a little colder than it is right now, and how much colder would it have to get for the ice to begin to advance? Really only about 5 or 6 degrees on the average, you know. If you just lowered the mean average temperature 5 or 6 degrees, the ice would begin to accumulate faster than it would melt, and it would move into the valley. Now, during the past million years, this valley has experienced that kind of ice, filled completely with ice, to the point that if you think of it, the ice would be a mile straight up over your head. You would be at the bottom of a mile of ice right here. And it filled right up to the upper levels of this valley, you see, and only the ridges were sticking out above those ice masses as they moved down the valley, moved through the valley down to Lake Chelan and all the way to the city of Chelan before the ice melted out. And that's where it left all the rock that it brought out of these canyons. And that's what makes the dam for the natural lake, Lake Chelan. And if you think now that during the past million years, that happened at least 3 times, that the valley was completely filled with ice, and it all melted back, and the forests came back, and it was like it is today for a long period of time. Then it happened again, and 3 times, and what we don't know, you see, as we look at these masses of ice, is whether we're at the tail end of the last cycle of glaciation or whether we're starting a new cycle, and that the cycle might advance through a new stage, you see, and fill the valley again. If it does, it's going to be hard on Holden Village, you know, a mile of ice above us. So, but don't get excited, it's not going to happen before you leave. Take a few thousand years, so it's nothing to worry about. Well, just think about it as you think about the shaping of these valleys and the history that goes with it. And, it's a fascinating story in itself. One question.
Was the Forest Service administering this area when the mine was being developed, like in the 30s?
Yes. A good question. Was the Forest Service in charge and administering this area when the mine was established and became House Island Mining Company operation? Yes. And they had to take and get, they had to get a use permit from the forestry people to build the village. And when they built the village and all of the facilities that are on this side, they had to agree further that if they ever abandoned the mine, they would remove all of those buildings so that the forest could grow back. That was a clear commitment on the part of the company. And that was a thing they had to deal with when they abandoned the mine. Now, is there a question at this point? What happens then? You know, they did abandon it. And the buildings are still there. Why is that? Well,
James Block was Secretary of the Interior.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe we should deal with that right now. We got a nice shady spot here, and the breeze is pretty good. Okay, we'll deal with that. When the mine closed in 1957, this obligation was very clear that they had to remove the buildings. Now, they saw a way out of this. If they could sell the property to a responsible party that the forestry people would approve of, then it would be their responsibility to carry on, and if they left, then to take the buildings down. Well, that's what they elected to do, and they elected to put this up on the market for sale, and they advertised it in the Wall Street Journal and in other financial journals. And the price was $200,000. You could buy the whole shooting match. And we've got competition here. This is like the LA freeways.
The bus is passing.
Well, okay, getting back now to this obligation. You know, in 57, they tried to sell it. 58, they tried to sell it. They couldn't make a sale, so they lowered the price to $100,000, and they tried to sell it for that. And at $100,000, they had one group that was interested in doing this, and they had the money. And it turned out to be a gambling syndicate. And the idea was to bring them up here and fleece them, you know, and turn them loose. Well, the forestry people wouldn't approve of that kind of a sale. They did not want that kind of thing going on in the forest, so they didn't approve of that. Now, did you have a question?
Was that to allow people to mine it also, or did they keep...
Do anything. You know, they were just willing to sell it. They didn't want to ever come back and mine it, so they were willing to sell it. And they were unable to sell it. Now, Wes Freed writes a letter. In 1957, he picks up a paper in Anchorage, Nebraska, or in Anchorage, in Alaska, and he sees that this mine is going to be closed. And so he writes, well, that letter attracts no attention, but he doesn't quit. You know, he keeps writing. And time goes on, and now it's 1959, and it's 1960, and the buildings are still there. And by this time, the pressure is really getting high on the company. And they've got to do something. And when they decide to do something, they did two things. And one we're going to see as we cross the bridge. They elected to let a salvage company come in here and take out anything they wanted to take out. They paid a fee to do that. And they were allowed then to take out steel out of the mill, the railroad, the tracks and all of that, so they recovered a lot of steel very easily, and they paid to do that. But in 1960 now, the company elects to call Wes Freed and see if he's for real, you know, and whether or not the gift could be made to him. So that starts the conversation. But in the meantime, the company had let a contract to the salvage company in 1959, and that had 2 years to go. Now, in 1960 is when the deal with the Lutherans was finally consummated, because when they found out that the gift would be going to LBI, Lutheran Bible Institute in Seattle, then the forestry people got into the act again, and they looked at that. That was not an acceptable way for the company to discharge their obligation either, because LBI did not have that kind of personnel, didn't have that kind of money, and there was no way that they could have handled taking the responsibility for this kind of an installation in the National Forest. That's when all the Lutherans get involved, because when LBI couldn't swing it alone, then they invited all of the others to join, and the whole thing came together, you see, and that became a very important kind of thing. Well, the salvage company was still here tearing things out when the Lutherans came in 1961 trying to put things together, you see, so there was a conflict of interest. But that finally ended, you see, because they had only a two-year contract, and we stayed on, and they dropped out, you see. So that's the way that worked out. Now,
who owns the ore then?
Who owns the ore?
The balance of the ore.
Who owns the ore? That's a key question. Now, the ore body and the patented mineral leases are now in the hands of the Holden Corporation, in Holden Incorporated, not for profit. Now, there's another facet to this that's very important to understand. Since the original gift, you see, was initiated by LBI, it was agreed at the point where they decided how this was to be divided up, that LBI was to be retain half of the mineral interests, and the balance of it then would be held by the board, which would be the balance of the Lutheran body. So LBI still retains a half interest in the ore minerals, whatever are there, you see. In a case the mine would be reopened, they would have a half interest in the ore body, you see, in that sense. Yeah. So that's the way it is. Now that's a patented mineral lease, and we do certain work to keep that in force. And that has to be reported on every year. And in doing so, you see, we keep those mineral leases intact. In the event that there should be an inquiry or somebody want to open the mine, the Holden Board has the say on what happens. And we're entirely in control, you see, in that sense. Because when the company made the gift, they couldn't hold any strings. They had to give the mineral rights, you see, as well as the building. Now they gave the buildings, and the buildings are on forest land. And we do not own the land over here, and we do not control that. And we could be asked to leave at any point, you see, from the forest land. And just to kind of give you, a feel for how firm this is, you know, we received a gift of the buildings and all of the facilities down at Lucerne. And that was a gift to Holden Village. And we wanted to develop that into a small community and serve the public down there. And we had that in as a proposition before the forestry people. And they finally elected to not approve that. And so when they did not approve of our being at Lucerne, they said, you own these buildings now, and we want you to remove all of those buildings as of last December. And we had that deadline to meet, and we met that deadline. So when you go to Lucerne now, all of the buildings that we got as a gift, including a restaurant and a schoolhouse and a number of cottages, you see, they're all level, and the forest is growing back. And that's exactly what would happen here. If we're asked to leave this area, we have to remove all of these buildings that we now occupy. We have a lease on the land. We have a lease, and we were given last year, we were given a 20-year permit, but that is reviewed annually and can be, you know, they can rescind that at any point. Now, what are the reasons that they might want us to leave? I think it's important that we all as a community understand how it is that we can stay here. And the fact is that we bring in the order of 5,000 people a year into the National Forest, to this facility, and they go out. If we were to have a poor safety record and a lot of accidents in relationship to that, the forestry people could very well say, it's not a safe operation and you really ought to close it down, and you would have to. The other thing is, if there is any question about our being good stewards up here in terms of fire, if we're a fire hazard in the National Forest, they obviously would not want us here. And there's a third reason that I want to mention to you and you don't forget. And that is the fact that if you ever have to show your Lutheran credentials to get into this place, we're in trouble. Because this is not a Lutheran place. This is a public facility. And it is a public operation. And we must always remember that, and also that we make room for anybody that wants to come here. And if we ran our business in such a way that only Lutherans were given preference and they got all the spots, you know, then the government would have to say, this is no longer a public place, and we can't have it. So that's an important consideration, one which we as a board are very aware of, and it's important to us.
How does that work with relationship to the selection of staff?
Selection of staff, the selection of board members, the selection of guests, everything else. You know, this has to be put in perspective. And we have to look at that. And if it ever got, you know, out of hand, then we're in trouble.
The mine itself, also a lease, or is that privately?
No, that is a patented mineral lease from another branch of the government entirely. And the forestry people have to allow us access to that acreage, which is over here. That's where the minerals are. And that, as long as we do something to keep those mineral leases active, then we have to be given access to those leases. One of the things we do to discharge our responsibility for that is to help work on this road, so that we get volunteer helpers, you see, to contribute labor that we then credit to keeping these leases, you see, intact. That keeps, because we own all of the trees over there. We own the forest, we own the mineral.
How big is that acreage?
We own, it can be 220 acres, 160 to 220 acres, depending on what's active and what's inactive. And right now, it's 160 acres. Now, let's go on a little.
How long is that patent now?
Forever. As long as you keep working. Here is, I wanted you to see the location of the miners' village, which is right ahead of us here, on the other side of this nice stone wall that somebody made, you know, and a house used to sit right on the other side of it. It's no longer there. And there were 100 homes right out in front of you here that are now entirely gone. When I came here in 1962, this is one of the places I came to. And I came up here and I crawled under the roofs that were caved in, and the pictures were still on the wall, and the dishes were in the sink, and the bedding was around, you know, in different places, and scattered all over were personal effects that were just left behind. This became a ghost town overnight, virtually, because on June 28, 1957, the company posted a notice that was the last day of operation, and get your paycheck, and that's it. These people had built their own homes. They had nobody to sell them to. And of course, there was nothing to do but to get out as soon as possible and get the next job that was available outside, because they no longer had a paycheck. And so they left, and many of them, you see, just left immediately and never came back for things. And so it was a disaster area when I saw it. And the roofs, you see, the forestry people said, well, it's not a safe place. And we got to get it all down. So what we did was cooperatively work together with the Forest Service. And we burned everything while the snow was still on in the spring, you know, bulldozed it together. Then after that, they bulldozed it out, and the way it is today. And you can see it's growing back green. Now, the forestry people use this right now, and you see there's an electric fence around the village here, because they bring in horses here now that service the trails. And that's the way it's being used at the present time. But this is where the village was, and I'm going to show you pictures up in the museum. And I'll spot you so that you know where you were, you see, when you were here. And so just kind of keep that in the back of your mind until you see these homes.
Is that a new house or one from the...
That's the Forest Service Guard. And that's one of the people that is a kind of a liaison communication between us and the Forestry Department. So you see they're right here in our midst. We live with their rules, which are our rules, you know, our department. And this, I think, is good for us. You know, it provides a discipline that is not bad for us to live under. And so we work with the forestry people, and we get along fine. Yes.
When all the miners left, did the company provide employment, or were they out on their own?
No, they were on their own entirely. The sign on the next tree ahead that says, danger, keep out, dismantling and wrecking. That is not a Lutheran sign. No, that's what was going on in 1960 and 61, you see, when we first started coming in here. Now, the reason I stop here is that there's always something good that happens out of these things, even though there was a conflict of interest. These people were taking out steel by the, you know, the ton. And one of the things that had happened when I came up here in 62, that bridge that went straight across here was getting mighty tired. It was built out of logs back in the early 1930s. And the logs were like that. And when a truck or a bus came up to that point, on either side, it was understood in a matter of policy and practice that everybody got out except the driver. And then the driver took the vehicle across, and if he made it, then the rest of us came across and joined it. But the salvage company had two great big beams of steel that were sitting right here where we're standing at the side of the road. They hadn't dared to move them across the bridge for fear the bridge would collapse. So they were going to save them till the last day. And then they were going to pull them across and to heck with the bridge. You know, they didn't care. But we knew that when we were here, we had to have a bridge across here to get to our garage over here, and so on. So that we made a deal. Now, what the deal was, I don't know. But we retained those two big beams, and you walked across them as you crossed the new bridge, which was built by volunteer help. You see, that came in and put in a new bridge, got those two heavy beams across. And that bridge has a safety factor like no other bridge you know. You just look at those beams.
How long ago was that finished?
I don't remember the exact year. Does anybody remember the year when that? It was in the early 70s. Early 70s. Come on. See, another agreement that the mining company had to have with the forestry people and the wildlife people was that Railroad Creek was a trout stream. And they must never forget that. And if the trout ever get unhappy, the company was in trouble. And so that meant that they could not allow polluted water to get from the mine into Railroad Creek directly. So what they did was pond it down here. And you can see the evidences of ponding in this valley here. Well, that had its effect too. because that water that settled here was obviously too much for some of the trees to take, and so some of the trees died as a result of that, but the trout stayed happy, and so that was a trade-off, I guess, at that particular point. Now, since it's shady here and it's sunny up there, I want to tell you what I'd like for you to look at as you go around the bend, and we're going to go up to the museum. Normally we stop there, but we won't this afternoon. I want you to look at the base of the mill, and we're going to talk about the mill when we get to the museum. The mill is on a gravity kind of principle, you see, everything started in at the top as coarse material, and by the time it got to the bottom, it was ready to be sold. So that was the principle of the mill, built on a gravity scheme, the engineering one. Now, the other thing, as you go around the corner, that's our garage, as you go around the corner, take a look at the gasoline pump. You know, that hasn't been changed since 1957. Look at the price of gasoline, but don't stay there too long and weep, you know, look at it, you know, and then go on. But the other thing you see immediately beyond that is a nice glacial deposit. And that is a deposit from the glaciers as they moved down the valley. Then they had to retreat back, you see, to where they are up there now. And it stopped at this point long enough to build up a moraine, a deposit. That's right next to the garage. And then on top of that deposit, there is a deposit of ash and cinders and pumice that came from an eruption of Glacier Peak. Glacier Peak is 20 miles away, and 12,000 years ago, it erupted and threw in a layer of ash and cinders about that thick in the Holden area, in this part of the valley. You can see it as you hike all through the valley. You can pick up those cinders and pumice and so on. And that's right where the trees are growing. If you watch, you can see that. And you can also, if you're interested, pick out pieces of that pumice, you see, that represent that. Very similar to Mount St. Helens. We got very little of the dust from Mount St. Helens here. But if Glacier Peak were to erupt, you see, that's not very far away. That's only 20 miles. And that's a whole different story. Well, we're going to go up to the museum, and then we're going to talk about the mill, and I'll entertain questions then about the mill and things that relate to that. You can gather in here just a minute. I want to tell you, if you want to sit down, you may, or you get comfortable, because I want to talk a little bit about the mine and the mill now. And we're in the assay house, the old assay house that the company built, and you're sitting on the floor that was poured in the early 1930s, and the foundation is exactly the same as it was for the assay house at that time. We asked the architect to give us a view of the mill and the down valley and also the tailings, both the mill tailings and the tailings that came out of the tunnel. And also, if we looked in that direction, we wanted to see Bonanza Mountain and North Star Mountain. And then we said, if you could also give us a view of Martin Ridge, at least the top of it, let's do that. And if you step clear back to this wall, you know, you don't have to do that right now, but do that. You can see Martin Ridge all the way from almost down at Lake Chelan clear up to Holden Lake, you know. So we got everything we asked for. And that's beautiful, and we're very grateful for this building, which is really a product of the contributions of people who come to Holden and elect to contribute something, and out of those contributions, we were able to put up this museum. So this kind of thing can happen where there's a community that's interested in having it done. Now, in order to find where the ore body was, you can see the cores, the diamond cores that are hanging on the wall there. And the geologist then, you see, was in charge of looking over those cores and directing that program. And what he did was to examine if those cores contained copper minerals, then the core was split. And you can see the tray in the bottom, that's the way they were preserved. and the cores that were split were sent to the assay office. And the assay office determined whether it was good enough to mine or whether it wasn't. So this was a kind of a nerve center for developing the ore body and identifying it. Then, when the mine began to operate, the mill, which is right outside here, had as its function to grind down all of the ore, rock, and mineral to a point where you could separate out the copper-bearing minerals. Now, the copper-bearing mineral that they were after was chalcopyrite, chalcopyrite. Now, that is made up of three things. It is one-third sulfur, it is one-third iron, and one-third copper. So even when you get this concentrate, such as what I have in this little container, you have to throw two-thirds of it away because you don't want the sulfur, you can't use the iron, so what you're after is the copper. The important thing is that the copper also, this copper mineral, also contains the gold. Now the gold, I told you that there was $21 million in gold that was recovered from here, and also at the price of $35 an ounce. They had between 600 and 700,000 ounces of gold. If you had that today at the price of gold at $400, 4 times 6, that'd be $240 million instead of $21 million. So you see, it might have been a very different thing in 1957 had the price of gold been anywhere near what it is today. The election might have been to stay here, and you know, then we wouldn't be here. So there's that to consider also. Now, what I want you to understand is that the grinding down process of the mill is the key thing in getting the material that could be sold. Now, what they did was to produce a concentrate of chalcopyrite, and that also contained the gold. Now, the best way I can illustrate this is to just walk around among you, and at least let some of you that come close by, stick your finger in this and see how fine it is. You know, I'll just walk as I talk here. Just put your finger in here. And you can see everything in the mill had to be ground down to this size. Now, when you get it down to this size, then it's manageable to separate. You have to do it to this size in order to create the separation. Now that means that when they got it ground down here, you got to get this thing. Okay, well, he's got gum. All right. Well, now you can see that when you get it this fine, then what they did was to mix it up in a slurry with water. Here, this is then you can see that now you may not want to wash your finger because you have all the gold on. That's copper and gold. So in order to get the gold out, you have to take it out chemically. Nobody ever saw any free gold from this mine, in spite of the fact that they recovered a lot of gold. Because when you get the gold freed from the copper mineral, it had an affinity for a manganese dioxide, which is black. And the two went together, and you could still not see the gold. So in spite of the fact that they couldn't see it, they still recovered a lot of gold. Now, the way they recovered that was to use what they called a flotation process. And the flotation process simply meant that you got it all stirred up in water, then in the bottom of the tank you put in pine oil. That's soap. And then you stir more and you put in air jets in the bottom and you create bubbles. And if you have time and come up here and look around, you see some beautiful pictures of the flotation tank where the bubbles are coming up. And what they did was to change the wetting properties of the chalcopyrite mineral so that it would hang on to the bubbles, but the rock would not. And so it picked up selectively the chalcopyrite in the slurry, and it brought it up on the bubble, and then all you had to do was scrape the bubbles off the top, and you had this concentrate.
And that's the way they got the copper mineral separated from the rest of the material, which was waste. Now, the waste material that was left over from this grinding process then went out onto this tailing pile down below, the orange tailing. And that is fine. That's as fine as this. And you see, it's mainly rock, but there's a lot of iron sulfide still left in that, pyrite and that sort of thing. And what's happened over the years is that it's simply oxidized and hydrated, and it's rust. So that's why the color. Those tailings were gray when they were put out there. And the people who put them out there, you know, that's the way they remember it. But now they're all rusted, and the color is what you see out there now. Now that's the waste product. That's the tailings. Now the other tailings are up above. That's the gray tailings, and they're the coarse material. And what you need to remember about that is that when they dug the tunnel back into the ore body, a half a mile, then they developed tunnels parallel to the ore body all the way from the top clear down to the bottom of 2,500 feet. Now there are 56 miles of open tunnels in Copper Mountain. You know, and they're still open as far as we know. And when you get back to the ore body was 80 feet across. You see, in many places there are rooms where they dug out the ore, where the room from the floor to the ceiling would be as much as 900 feet. You know, they're 80 feet across. Tremendous rooms. And then they ran this way, you see, for all these, what is this distance, you see, it could run, you see, for a half a mile horizontally. And so that's the kind of holes that there actually is in Copper Mountain. That's why we say Copper Mountain is off limits. It's not a good place to hike. We don't know whether those things will cave in, but, you know, at some point in time, they obviously have to do that. Now, I know we have trouble with time. We always do. So I want you to reassemble yourself so we can see the pictures right inside here. And then we're going to head up to the top of the canyon. Everything apart more than what they had planned. So that's the way it worked. Here's the ore face now. This is the barren rock. Here's the ore. Now the next one shows you, here's the ore that they're digging holes into and will blast off material, bring it to the mill. This is one of the big rooms back in the ore body. Here's an attempted photograph of it. See these people down here? You know, that is a tremendous hole in the mountain. You see it. You get no perspective when you look into a hole like that in the black. They had some accidents. They were mainly people kinds of accidents. The company had a good safety record. This is the lunchroom back off of the hoist room. Notice the date. The mine closed, you see, June 28, 1957. So these pictures were taken a little ahead. The company knew the mine was closing. I mean, the top official. Why didn't they tell the people up in the village? They didn't know. For the simple reason that as soon as you said you're going to close the mine, they would all have left. You know, they wouldn't have cared for that last time that they had with this company. They would be looking for the future. Well, this is a ventilation tunnel, and that's another one. This is the way it looked in front of the portal at the time it was in operation. This is the way the mill looked in the wintertime with the snow. This is the way it looked in the summertime. Tremendous, beautiful building, you see. It was very well constructed. Here's the way they got the tailings out to the lower part here, you see, where all the orange tailings are. There's 80 acres of those tailings, and they're as much as 80 feet thick. You know, so it's a tremendous fault.
How did they get them out there?
With water. They forced them out through these pipes, if you see. There's a pipe right outside of the door there. And they ran it across these trestles out to the end of the tailing. Here's where you're sitting right now. And the little sample that you put your finger into came off of one of these shells. It was an assayer sample.
because what the assayer had to do when they got the concentrate, they loaded it into big buckets, and each bucket had 5 tons. The assayer went out and took a sample and brought it in here, and then he put it in his ovens and extracted the metal from the concentrate, told the company how much money they should get for that batch of concentrate. Well, the Tacoma smelter bought that concentrate on the dock right down below here. Obviously, they could not take the word of the Howe Sound Mining Company assayer as to what it was worth. So, right in the next room in this same building was an assayer for the Tacoma smelter. And he would run the sample. And if they both agreed, then there was no problem. If they didn't agree, there was always a third assayer that could be called in, and he would run the sample, and then they would knock heads until they agreed on what the value of the particular batch was. Now, this is the way this building looked, you see, just before we started putting up this structure. And this is the floor you're on right now. This is a man who worked as a trucker up here for 10 years. And he helped haul that concentrate down those switchbacks. Now think of it now, a flatbed truck, and they loaded 3 of these big pails, each weighing 5 tons. That's 15 tons, plus the fact that the pail weighed 1,600 pounds. You know, on top of that, 3 of those. And that had to go down the switchbacks. Now the problem, obviously, was brakes. How do you brake going down? And what they finally devised was that they put a tank of water over each wheel. And when they got to the switchback, they turned on the spigot and let the water run over the brakes as they went down the switchback. Well, I asked this man if there were any accidents. Yeah, he said there was an accident. He said one driver who had a Charlie horse in his brain, I guess, on the way going down, forgot to check the water in the tank before he started down the hill. And he got halfway through the switchbacks and ran out of water and burned out the brakes, and over the side he went. And truck, concentrate and all. Fortunately, he didn't get killed. But yes, he said that was the kind of thing that could happen and did happen. Now, these are his pictures. He said, I'll give you some pictures of what the snow was like. And you can see that they fought the snow day and night, all winter long as it accumulated. This was a little patrol grader that ran up and down to see that everything was okay. Here is the dock, approximately where you landed, the company dock. And the trucks came down here, and then they offloaded to the barge. Now the next picture is down on the bar, or down on that level, and the next picture you see is where this had lifted off the pails onto the barge that's here. Now just add up in your mind 5 tons for each one of those, you know. And here's the little tugboat out in front, pulling the whole thing down to the city of Chelan, and then it has to get transferred again to the trucks, and then to the railroad cars, and then the buckets come back and they fill them up again. And this went on. You see, they put 2,000 tons of ore through that mill in a day. And if they were lucky, or if it ran properly, then they would get about 15 of these pails a day to 18 pails a day. That meant that to keep them from accumulating up here, whether it was snow or not, they had to get them down, they had to keep that whole thing going, and they never shut down for 20 years. You see, they kept it going, and it was a constant operation. Here's Mr. and Mrs. Barquist, Mr. and Mrs. Honeymoon. I can see they were just married. He came back and with his wife in 1966, hadn't seen the place since 1932. It was his recommendation that it all be done. And he was very grateful when he came back to see what had happened. He was a Lutheran from the Chicago area. And he thought this must have been God's plan. You know, it all worked out this way. Well, beautiful. This was one of the mine superintendents that had charge of the area over here for 10 years. Now we're in the village. Now, this is where you, no, this is the village proper, and you can see that there are no trees here. And it looks quite different on Main Street. Not that much different here. But this is the village where you work. Now, you were right here. And these are all of the houses that you did not see. That's the way they work. Here are some of them. And you get glimpses, you see, of these homes that were built by the people. Here's a fall, autumn view. Beautiful set. You know, people loved that village, and it was a good community. Everybody says. But look at these homes. Some of them are very substantial, but you know, they gave way to the snow when there was nobody there to clean the roofs. You can see how the snow would accumulate. Here's a winter scene of the same village, now gone. Good place to sled. Kids had lots of fun, yeah, but they also had to shovel snow. Lots of snow. Here you can see how it piled up against the houses. If you didn't keep it free of the roofs, they'd finally crush them. Here it is. But they also had fun skiing. They had a downhill ski. See the ski pole? And that pulled them up the side right next to the village where they lived. And here they are, out on the ski slope, you see, with Bonanza in the background.